So this opening story, I realized, might need a little context, which means it's not that great of an opening story, so bear with me. Apple pie. If you eat apple pie, there's something else you need to make it really taste good. What is that? Yes, I thought you were going to say. What's another option besides ice cream? Cheese. Yes, good. Okay, so I'm not completely alone. Apple pie and cheese. These go together. So now with that out of the way, this woman is having her pastor over for dinner. And she's very excited to have the conversation and to get to know him a little bit better. And at the end, she serves apple pie and she apologizes to him, saying, "I'm sorry, pastor, but we're out of cheese. So we aren't able to serve the apple pie with the cheese, but I hope the pie will be enough." And the pastor said, that's all right, and started to eat. And then her son, about 6 years old, comes into the room holding a little block of cheese and put it on the pastor's plate. And the pastor smiled and looked and thought, "You have sharper eyes than your mom, son," and ate that block of cheese. Said, where did you find it? And the boy, just beaming with pride, said, "It was right there in the rat trap." There are some types of hospitality we could probably do without. Well, this morning, we have the opposite of that horrible example of hospitality. We have Jesus being the consummate host. In a passage that doesn't seem to speak much about hospitality, I think we'll see that the Holy Spirit, through the gospel writer, is giving us a message about how Jesus came and how we are supposed to go. So in the context of this text, we don't know how much time has passed between Jesus and his encounter on the temple steps with the Jewish leaders and this mountaintop experience. John uses that favorite phrase of his, meta tauta. And next, I want to tell you about this. We do know some time has gone, because the context leads us to believe there have been many miracles, many signs that are getting the people excited to the point where many are following him. That said, the gospel writer had a method to the way that he ordered things in his gospel. So I want to remind us of the closing verses of chapter 5. Verse 45. "Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one who accuses you, Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe of me, because he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words?" And now John takes us to this hillside. As readers, the idea of Moses, the great patriarch, the giver of the law, God's own leader, prophet, ringing in their ears, we pick up with chapter 6. The next thing I want to tell you, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Just one geographical note. This means that most people would have had to go a healthy distance to see Jesus. This is not a quick, we're going to catch a movie 15 minutes away from home, and then when we're bored or tired, we can leave. This is an all-day affair. This is a big journey to see him. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. This next verse is not a random throwaway. This next verse is the key to understanding all of chapter 6. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. You hear this language of mountaintop. You have the words of the evangelist ringing in your ear, having finished the previous chapter, and you're thinking about Moses, and now Jesus is going up to the top of the mountain. Mountains are where cool things happen in the Hebrew Scriptures. You know, it was on Moriah that the sacrifice, Abraham of Isaac, was going to occur, and God provided a suitable substitute. It was on Mount Sinai that Moses ascended and God gave him the law. It was on Mount Moriah again where Solomon was told, build your temple. The mountaintops, they point us to this high and exalted God. And now Jesus comes up to this mountaintop, and we can expect another divine encounter. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, is at hand. In the Gospel of John, the Passover comes up three times. We've already seen it once. Now we're seeing it again. And in both of the instances where we're seeing it here early in the Gospel, it's pointing ahead to his death. First time we saw it was when he was in the temple and he threw over those tables and he said, there will come a day, tear this temple down, in 3 days I will rebuild it. He's pointing to his death. Now in chapter 6, it's Passover. And we're going to see this week and next week and the following week and the next week. Chapter 6 is a good chapter. It is pointing again to his death. The third time we see Passover, it's in the context of the sacrifice of Jesus. So Passover is a big deal. And we can't think about Passover without thinking of a significant historical figure, Moses, whose name we've already heard. The picture of the mountaintop is now in our mind, and Jesus is going to continue. In verse 5, I love this phrase, lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him. I love this picture of Jesus getting away, just getting away to breathe. He and his disciples have been working and ministering hard, and he lifts up his eyes, and he sees the people. And what he sees is their need. I find great comfort there, that the God who sustains creation lifts up his eyes, and he sees. And he says to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Heidi nailed this. He said this to test him. Jesus knew what was going to happen. He knew what was going on, but he was testing Philip. Philip answered him the way that I think most of us would. We look out, and we see, well, there's 13 of us, and there's a whole lot of them. Man, if we had 8 months' worth of income, we could give everybody a morsel, and that would just make them hangry. That's angry and hungry together. That's not enough. Even if we had that much, he starts calculating. He starts doing the math. Andrew pipes up, the brother of Simon Peter, and at least Andrew went out into the crowd and started doing an inventory. And he comes back with pretty much the same response that we had from Philip. Well, we have some loaves and we have some fish, but what could we do with that, with so many? Right now, the disciples in this passage are representing me. They're representing us. All too often, situations come up in life, and we do the calculus, and we see how desperate the situation is, and we walk away. In other gospel accounts, the disciples actually gave that instruction. Well, Jesus, send them away to go get something to eat. Send them away. Here in the Gospel of John, we don't have that report. Instead, we have Jesus' response. He knew what he was going to do. The disciples, they should have known. What had they seen at this point? Quite a bit more than we know that they've seen, but what we know that they've seen is Jesus healing the official son without even laying eyes on him. Taking this lame man, 38 years, unable to care for himself, and enabling him to walk. Miracle after miracle, sign after sign, they've seen, and here's a problem. And they have no idea. they have no idea how it's going to be solved. So we look at the inventory. Verse 9. There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many? Now, Philo, the great historian, has something to say about the barley loaves. And we have reflections of this through Scripture. Barley is not the bread that you want to eat. The good bread is wheat bread, not barley bread. Listen to how Philo describes barley loaves. As foodstuff, it is of somewhat doubtful merit. It's best suited for irrational animals and men in unhappy circumstances. And the word that's used for fish, it actually means tidbit. So it's like the boy had a couple of those little fish crackers, goldfish, and these barley loaves, and that's all he had. So Jesus, I wish I could see his face looking at Andrew after he gets the inventory. But Jesus tells them, have the people sit down. There's a lot of people in the room, out field. I'm guessing it takes a while to get everyone's attention and to get them to sit down to eat. Now there was grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. So a little curiosity of the text, have the people sit down. There's a Greek plural there that is people. And then it gets specific. So the men sat down. 5,000 men in number. Whether the number is 5,000 or what I'm about to say is accurate, it's a lot of people. But most people believe, pun intended, that the people included women and children. The men that sat down were about 5,000. That means we're looking at 10 to 15,000 people on this hillside about to have lunch. The scale of this miracle is mind-blowing. It is the only miracle that occurs in all 4 Gospels. It's the best known and the most strongly attested to of Jesus' miracles. So he has 10, 12,000 people sitting down about to eat. Jesus then took the loaves, 5 barley loaves, and when he had given thanks, again, I'm looking forward to the day when we have access to the high-definition DVD library, when we can watch these things, because I'm seeing this crowd of thousands of people sitting in the field, and this teacher has these 5 pieces of bread, these 5 loaves, and he gives thanks for them to distribute to this mass of people. But then, that's what the text says, it's exactly what he did. He didn't delegate this. He did this. And when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish. Do you get the little line after the comma there? As much as they desired. Thousands of people. And Jesus distributes the food. And when they had eaten their fill, no mere morsels here, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. So they gathered them up, and there was an abundance beyond the 5 and 2. There were 12 baskets of food. So I want to backtrack a little bit to the problem I said that we shared with the disciples, that I share, at the very least, with the disciples. All too often, my view of God is too small. My view of Jesus and what he's capable of doing is limited. And things come up in life, and I got to take care of it. No one else is going to take care of this. I got to figure it out. And I forget the relationship I have with the one who created the universe. I forget the relationship I have with the one who is holding up the very pews that are holding you up right now. I have too small of a view of Jesus. And the disciples, having seen him do what he does, how are we going to feed all these people? I don't know. I mean, if we had a year's worth of income, we wouldn't be able to feed all these. We only have 5 loaves and 2 fishes. What are we going to? And Jesus says, just watch. And when it's all over, how many baskets are left over? I don't want to get too caught up in numbers, but there are 12 baskets overflowing with bread and fish. 12 baskets of extra. And I just see 12 embarrassed disciples walking home going, I don't know why we didn't think he could do it. I don't know why. 12 reminders, one for each of them. Your view of Jesus was too small. You had a deficient view of your teacher. You know, Thomas Carlyle said, men are like the gods they serve. We're called to be like Jesus. And Jesus, in this situation, well, none of us are going to be able to feed the 5,000 in quite the way that Jesus did. But Jesus came, and what did he do? He lifted his eyes, he saw a need, and he served the people. When the people saw the sign that he had done, again, the DVD player, he hands out a loaf, and then he hands out another loaf, and then he hands out 2 loaves, and then he's, can you imagine the murmur on the hillside as this magician keeps pulling rabbits out of the hat, and you know that the hat has a false bottom and there's plenty of room in that hat for 2 rabbits, and then suddenly there's thousands of rabbits coming out of the hat. It's a horrible analogy. But can you imagine the reaction of the people? What is happening right now? What are we seeing with our own eyes? This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. The promised prophet, the Deuteronomy 15 prophet, has come. And you know what? Amen. They got it right. They nailed it. Yes. But he is far more, and he's not coming the way that you want him to. Verse 15. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. What was this? This was a rebuke of these people. They had a picture of Messiah, and the Messiah that they wanted was one where God works for their purposes and not his own. The Messiah that they wanted was the one that they saw that was going to take them out of subjugation to the Roman Empire and allow them to stand on their own, where they would no longer be living from fishnet to fishnet, paycheck to paycheck, but they would have abundance. That's the Messiah that they were looking for. And they were right. He is the prophet, and he is the king. But they had the wrong view of what he was supposed to do. Let me read to you what one commentator said that really captured my imagination. Jesus himself knew that the way his kingdom would triumph would not be by beating the enemy in siege warfare, but by dying and rising from the dead. He would go to Jerusalem not to wield the spear and bring the judgment, but to receive the spear thrust and to bear the judgment. That's not the king that they were expecting. That's not the king that they were desiring, but it is the king that they and we desperately need. So what? What does this passage have for us? Well, the first application I hope should be somewhat obvious. What is your conception of your God? Is he capable? Is he big enough? Is your concept of God one that defies the imagination, or is it so limited that God can't do what you would desperately pray he is capable of doing? Do you have to meet your own needs, or do you count on him to meet your needs through you? How big is your God? Do you limit him? Second idea is this idea of hospitality. I think of hospitality, and the first thing that comes to mind is someone who opens up the door to their house and says, "You have refrigerator privileges. You can come in this door anytime you want, and you can walk up to that fridge, and you can take what you want. You don't need to ask to come in, and you don't need to ask for a glass of water, because my house is your house. My water is your water. If we're out of cheese, go buy some cheese. Don't go to the rat trap." That's the picture of hospitality that's in my mind. Jesus shows us a slightly different model of hospitality. Jesus' definition of hospitality, because he is the perfect host, is completely giving of himself. He has invited us into his kingdom, but he has given everything of himself to his guests. We see it in the history that we've been given so far in the Gospel of John. In John chapter 2, he is a better host than the bridegroom because he saved the best for last. In John 4, he was showing hospitality to the Samaritan woman where he not only offered her water to drink, but he offered her streams of living water. We see it again in John chapter 13. We'll get there when Jesus gets down on his knees and washes his disciples' feet. He is the consummate host. We are his guests, and he's inviting us in. Do we take him seriously? And do we desire to show hospitality in the same way? Now, the Christian life, under the power of the Spirit, is about walking as Jesus walked. It's about serving as Jesus served. And it's about doing what Jesus did, not feeding the 5,000, but making the Father known and giving him glory through everything we say and do. So I think of those baskets that the disciples walked away with, being reminded that Jesus is capable. In the new member class last hour, we talked briefly about gifts and service. And I know that there have been times in my life where I've been in a church and I looked at what I had to give in service to the church, and the answer in my mind was nothing. What do I have to offer? I can't do what that guy does. I can't do what she does. They don't need me here. What do I have? I have nothing. Well, let me suggest that if you have nothing, that you give that. You give yourself. Because it is through the nothing of us that Jesus works. It's through our brokenness and our weakness that his strength is seen. And I look at one of the ways that we can share from those baskets in abundance that doesn't come from us, but that comes from him. One of those ways is doing what we've been doing at R.T. Hill, going out and praying with and for the teachers, greeting the students, serving others. But another way is to support those who are modeling the hospitality of Jesus, which is Jesus going. Jesus came, and he dwelt among his people, and he served them, and he poured himself out. Not all of us could go to Hungary, but all of us could pray for and support those men and women who went to Hungary. Not all of us can go to Uganda, but we can pray for and support those who are going to Uganda. So for this last application, I'm going to do something that seems a little strange. If I could ask the